Welcome to episode 12 of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, gear, and most certainly watches. I'm Jason Heaton.
And I'm James Stacey. Today we're going to do something a bit different. We received a thought-provoking question from a listener, and this one simple query is actually going to be our main topic for this episode. So Scott kindly wrote in and asked, if both of you could pick one watch to be your only watch forever, which would get the nod, and why? So this is kind of like a perennial question. I've heard this many times. I've been asked it on Instagram and in emails before. And I think it's fun to do as a conversation. I think as a one-sided thing, it's a little bit dry. And then as an added mix, while Jason and I generally can see kind of a mass idea, like a notes for the show, we've separated our notes. So I actually don't know what watch Jason selected or why. And he doesn't know what I've selected. And we haven't chatted about it beforehand. So, you know, Scott, this is a great question, and I'm really excited to dig in on it. So I think it's fair to limit this hypothetical exercise to answers that are realistically within the realm of what Jason and I would actually spend on a watch. So it's not really like a one lottery watch. It's more of the, you know, one watch that we would actually buy and then wear forever. Sound about right, Jason?
Yeah, that's kind of my take on it as well. I mean, I think, you know, funny thing is I think the types of watches you and I gravitate towards are generally not the $50,000, you know, Patek chronograph or something like that. Anyway, so I think we're probably going to be pretty aligned on budget and kind of type of watch, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, I would expect so. And the idea that it's going to be the one watch that you wear really presents like a number of factors that you have to consider. And this would be a ludicrous question for somebody who maybe doesn't care so much about watches, like where it's an appliance or, you know, something they have because their peers all wear watches. With a watch nerd, I mean, like a huge part of this hobby is actually enjoying and getting and moving around and experiencing new watches. So, I mean, I think if I had to pick one, I mean, I have a watch that already kind of fits the parameter, but it would be too boring to select it. And that would be my Explorer 2 from Rolex. I picked that watch because I really liked it. I took a long time to kind of pick it out from other various options. But I think it works roughly as a framework for what I would be looking for in the one watch discussion, because I like a GMT. I like decent water resistance. I like something that's not too big. I like something that theoretically you could wear all the time in any situation. And I like a watch. And you know, if you're going to have that one watch, you also have to consider, like, what watch isn't likely going to give me a lot of trouble as far as maintenance. And you can get a Rolex serviced quite reliably wherever. And they're known and have a long-standing history for being very robust, tough-wearing, you know, ready-to-roll watches. And I think that's probably something that would apply importantly to this sort of a decision. So ignoring a watch that I already have because it would be boring, it is a little tempting to go with something like really expensive because it's, you know, you're only going to have one. And I'm fairly tempted by something like the Patek Philippe, the Travel Time.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So the Aquanaut, not the chronograph, just the you know, it has a separate hand for another time zone. Another 12-hour time zone, and then it has the pointer date, so it's the 5164A001 on the rubber strap. That watch is never going to be out of place, and it's 120 meters water-resistant, beautifully made. You're not going to run into a lot of issues as far as service goes or the quality of the movement. It's 40.8 millimeters, so the sizing's really nice, and the functionality's there. It's not a dive watch. It's not really like your traditional GMT watch. It's not giving you a 24-hour display, but I think it has like an X factor that I've always kind of loved. It's largely disqualified because I don't think I would actually go out and spend that much on a watch. It's just, you know, given my background, my middle class background and everything, I see a watch like that and think like, well, maybe someday, like in a lottery scenario, or if things went really well, sure, you could talk your way into that. But I think it would belie the purpose of this this discussion, but I would be remiss not to mention that watch.
That's a really interesting sort of first stake in the ground for me to hear from you. I that wasn't even on my radar. I'm surprised you mentioned it, but I think it brings up an interesting point. It's one of my factors or criteria if I think about a one watch candidate. And that is, you know, there are things like the ruggedness to be able to kind of take on almost anything you can do with it, because you'd be wearing it for pretty much everything. But also, I mean, there's this intangible sense of a watch that I was thinking about that's actually quite important on my list of criteria. And that is a watch that is interesting enough that would keep me engaged for a really long time. Because if it's the only watch you're wearing, you know, as somebody that collects watches, I don't have a huge collection, but, you know, like you, James, I'm kind of in this because I enjoy getting new stuff and kind of checking it out and wearing it for different things. But if I just had one, that aspect of watch collecting goes away.
Yeah.
If, you know, assuming this is a self-imposed sort of life sentence of one watch. So I want something that every time I look at it, I see something new or there's something that keeps me interested. So I, you know, I can kind of see where you're coming from on that travel time Aquanaut, because it has that. It has the great finishing, it has the cool dial and the interesting complication. You know, plus it's a sports watch. So yeah, I could get on board with that. It wouldn't be on my list, but that's an interesting first sort of foray.
And as far as like still being in the watch community, you could do worse than being the guy that's just always wearing an Aquanaut.
Oh, you'd be the cool guy. I mean, yeah.
Like, I think they're an immensely cool watch. I personally find them to be like aesthetically beautiful, and you could very much, it's the sort of watch where it would change its personality with the strap.
Yeah.
It's one of the few watches where I totally understand that the rubber is probably the A option.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really comfy. The sizing's just right. The functionality's cool. You could wear it pretty much anywhere, and it still has some nerd credibility. And like you said, it has that sort of, it's, I think it's so good that despite seeing new things that I guess you couldn't get because of this one watch sentence, I think you would still look at it and be like, oh, I'm doing okay. I'm not hard done by here.
Right.
You know, it's one of the legendary names within watchmaking. I love that it's from a brand that's typically seen as a dress watch manufacturer. I think that's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's neither a chronograph, you know, like a perpetual chronograph or something like that, nor a dress watch. But it has those qualities to it, that sort of timelessness in the design and its Agenta design. And I think there's a lot to like there. And if the budget was not so much of an issue, I think this would have been like a serious contender for me, and not something that I simply mention because I think it's such a really, really cool watch.
Yeah.
You know, do you have anything in your list that would kind of match up with that?
Not really. And I think the reason is because another one of the factors on my list, along with something just really interesting to look at all the time, is one of my really strong factors is unobtrusiveness. A watch that, I don't want to necessarily say it blends in because I don't want a bland watch, but something that doesn't necessarily draw attention to itself no matter where I find myself. I tend to, you know, travel a lot, and I hate the thought, you know, I remember used to read forum posts from people that would say, oh, I'm going on vacation to Mexico, which watch should I take? And, oh, leave your Rolex at home, leave your, you know, whatever it is at home, and, you know, get a G-Shock. And I'm like, that always defied my sense of who I am. You know, I want my one watch to be one that accompanies me anywhere I go and on all my adventures. And I think the Patek might, you know, just might, it could force some uncomfortable situations if you're sitting at a dive bar in some little town in, you know, Tijuana or something like that, and you're wearing that on your wrist. So that might negate that one for me. I guess when you talk about something or it doesn't line up at all with the Aquanaut, but something that kind of fits that mold of something that's interesting enough to keep me engaged, and I think it's a watch you love as well, is a Doxa, and it's the 750, the sub 750T, the GMT.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about it, I think, on past shows. I think it was on my Ones That Got Away show.
Yeah, and list. It's on my list for tonight.
Oh, so okay.
We can scratch it off my list, too. I think it's just, like, if you were going to stick in the realm of an ETA-based watch,
mm-hmm.
That's an absolute fave.
Yeah. And you know what? You know, I had one for 6 months or maybe a year. I can't remember. But the thing about that watch, and Doxa is one of those companies, the watches, they're kind of polarizing in their design. Some people look at them and just think they're ugly. It's got this weird bezel that sticks up off the case, this funky handset. But if you get into them, they're the coolest watches, you know. And I think it's a watch that, especially that one with the inner rotating, you know, 24-hour scale, the no deco limit bezel, that skeletonized oversized second hour hand, you know, it's a watch that every time you look at it from every different angle, it keeps you engaged, and it's just fun, you know. Especially if I had the Diving Star version, which I think is kind of the cool one. I think you like the Caribbean, the blue one as well. But
I do. Those are the two good ones, though, the blue, orange, and the yellow.
Okay, they might not be the most versatile. So, you know, if you talk about one watch, gee, can you wear it with a suit or a tuxedo? Well,
no chance.
I don't find myself in those situations often. So, yeah, I might not be able to wear it in those situations. But then again, maybe I would. But, you know, it is a watch that if you had for 10 years down the road and it's all scratched up and beat up, it's going to look better. And chances are, assuming it's rugged enough to kind of survive that long, which I think it would be, I think it's one of those watches that could sustain me for a very long time.
Yeah, I would agree. I think they're a really excellent design, and they have just enough additional functionality without changing the overall appeal of the Doxa Sub.
Yeah.
Like, you still get the relative appeal of the three-hander. And it doesn't go as far into kind of a whole different thing as the chronograph.
Right.
I love that, like with most Doxa watches, you have all of the color options. And that blue-orange, I think I've mentioned before, that I got a chance to see it at Baselworld a couple years ago, you know, in person. And it had like I had an instant reaction to how, like to the having it on wrist. The appeal is really strong.
Yeah.
And it was an easy contender for this list. You know, it has a functionality, the GMT functionality that I love. And yeah, sure, maybe it wouldn't work with a suit. But again, I guess I would just not wear the watch, or I'd put it in my pocket if I was really that worried about it.
Yeah.
And just be, you know, adopt some, you know, kind of presumptuous line about how when I go out to some nice party, I don't wear a watch because I'm not worried about time. And then make everybody else feel bad for wearing their JLCs and Pateks and such. So,
you know, this brings up another point, I think, with this watch and maybe the Aquanaut to a certain degree, is another one of my criteria for a one watch is relatively uncomplicated. I think at most, and some of the candidates I have at most a GMT function. Chronographs, I think, are cool. There's a place for them. I've got a couple of them. I know you do too. But at most, I think I would go as far as a GMT. I think it's got the right functionality to it. But I also think, you know, it in terms of serviceability or just reliability, you know, 5 years down the line, you see you're out on some trek in the Andes or something like that, and you look down and your chronograph hand is crooked or it's not re-zeroing correctly or something, that would annoy me. Whereas a GMT is a pretty reliable complication on any kind of watch.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, that's a good point with the serviceability and the reliability. And I think you also have an increased servicing cost, which I think matters, I guess. Within the confines of this discussion, I think it matters is that, you know, you will pay more to service a chronograph, especially an in-house chronograph, and typically their service windows are shorter than, say, a comparable three-hand or a light complication like a GMT,
right?
Or pointer date, something like that. But it does bring me to kind of my next watch, which is actually a GMT chronograph. So I would be tempted to say that I have a Zin 144 GMT, which is a 40 millimeter kind of hooded lug GMT chronograph from Zin. And I think it would make an amazing single watch, save for the relative complexity of the movement. But you get a huge amount of functionality there. So if you needed to be able to time things, the chronograph is better than a bezel for some situations, not for diving, but for timing regular life events up to, say, 12 hours, it's really handy. And it was probably one of the first chronographs I personally bought. I had plenty in for review and never really took to it. And then I saw the Zin in person and I just loved it. I love that it's almost ridiculously complicated depending on where the hands are.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have fairly similar handset and a lot of lume and big numerals. And I love the watch. I think it's great. I don't want to pick a watch that I already have, but I mean, if I was going that route, I really do like the Zin 103 Ti UTC Testaff.
Oh, yeah. I like that too.
So that's the titanium. It has an external bezel, which my 144 doesn't have. So it has a countdown bezel, which doesn't work for diving. But there are a lot of things you can do with a countdown bezel. And otherwise, it's very similar to the 144, but you have a titanium case.
Yeah.
And you still come in at 41 millimeters. It's quite thick at 17 millimeters, and I'm sure that would bother me, which, again, is one of the reasons it's not a final decision for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I really love this watch. It's great value, beautifully made. The Testaf stuff is going to be a way of ensuring that it is as robust as possible, so you have all sorts of technical requirements for waterproofness and shock resistance. It's 200 meter water resistant, low pressure resistant. It has temperature resistant technologies. It has their AR dehumidifying technology. So if you want something tough, I think if you're going to buy say an ETA based chronograph and you wanted one of the ultimate expressions, I think you're down between Zin and, you know, one of the many Braemonts we've chatted about many times.
Yeah, I think Zin is a really strong contender for a one watch because of their legendary, you know, ruggedness. And ruggedness is the top thing on my list of criteria, just because, you know, it's got to put up with whatever I throw at it. And I think also, even though I don't have a chronograph on my list, a chronograph kind of meets that factor of being interesting enough to keep me engaged. It's a watch that, you know, there really isn't another watch like a chronograph that you can play with. You know, I mean, you can spin a bezel on a dive watch, but that gets kind of boring after a couple of spins. But a chronograph you can just do cool stuff with. You know, you can start and stop it. You can time pretty much anything you want. And it's really cool. It's funny you bring up Braemont, because the second watch on my list is actually a Braemont, and it's one that's actually not available on the, you know, new anymore, because it was a limited edition, but it's the Terra Nova. That would be kind of my second candidate for a one watch. I think it meets so many of my criteria. I think it's for those maybe not familiar with the Terra Nova, it was the watch that was based on the Supermarine 500 dive watch that Braemont still makes. 43 millimeter case, 500 meter water resistance, the Terra Nova, what they did to that one was they added a GMT function. They swapped out the dive bezel for a compass bezel. And they made the case out of titanium. And it was done for a polar expedition done by a guy that I know James and I both admire, Ben Saunders, who's a British polar explorer who recreated Robert Scott's trek to and from the South Pole a couple of years ago. And, you know, the watch ticks almost all of my boxes. I think just visually, it's a beautiful watch. And the 43 millimeter case, I own a Supermarine 2000, which is, it's a great watch. I wear it a lot, but it's big and it's heavy. The Supermarine 500 is a 43 millimeter case, so it's just about the perfect size and made of titanium. It makes that watch, I've tried it on, it's so comfortable. It's such a perfect size and weight. And, you know, like you, I'm a big fan of GMT functionality, and that one's got it. And it's just a great watch to look at. It's a cool watch to play with. It would certainly stand up to pretty much anything I could throw at it, especially if it was tested by a guy who dragged a sled to and from the South Pole. It kind of straddles. I mean, you could kind of get away with it as even a dress watch in a pinch. It's not a dress watch per se, but, you know, it's nice looking, has a refinement to it. And I happen to like the brand. I like Braemont a lot. So, you know, the Terra Nova kind of ticks a lot of boxes. It ultimately isn't the winner of my one watch selection, but it's definitely high on my list.
Yeah, the Terra Nova was also in the running for my list. It's one of my absolute favorite Braemonts. They only made 300. Like you said, the titanium makes a really noticeable difference to that S500 case. It has some nice detailing on the dial with the kind of globe pattern that gives you just a little bit of extra something to appreciate about it. And like you mentioned, you know, I'm sure most of the time you could wear it on rubber or on a NATO, but if you put it on an alligator strap or a leather strap, that's going to dress that watch up in pretty considerably, especially for kind of a chunky dive watch. So I think it is a fairly versatile design. It uses color nicely with the GMT hand. And yeah, I'm not sure that you can actually pinpoint a lot of other watches that were put through the sort of beating that it would have gotten on the Terra Nova expedition. So I think you could safely say that it's going to hold up as far as being your everyday watch. It was their everyday watch through some of the worst the world had to offer. So a really cool piece.
Yeah, and it's also, again, I mean, you kind of can arguable sides, but in terms of like having an ETA-based or sort of off-the-shelf outsourced movement or something in-house like a Rolex or a Seiko or something like that, and there are pros and cons to both, I guess. But you know, Bremont does a lot of fine tuning to ETA movements to bring them up to chronometer specification. But again, if you were somewhere where there wasn't ease of servicing from a Bremont retailer or be able to send it in to their headquarters, you know, chances are a good watchmaker could take the back off and give it a service, which I think is, you know, when it comes to sort of long-term ownership and just owning one watch, I think that's kind of an important thing to consider.
No doubt. I would totally agree that I think the average would be to send it back to Bremont,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's a specialized design as far as the case and everything. But I would think that, yeah, your local, you know, good watchmaker could certainly deal with that. And in a pinch, most likely any city's really good watchmaker could deal with it. And my guess is it's something that would run for a really long time before it showed any mechanic, like all of these watches could run for a very long time, well beyond their service window, which will degrade parts and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not, you should always get a watch serviced when it's supposed to be serviced, even if it's still running okay.
Yeah.
But I think that's that Terra Nova is a really interesting, you know, an interesting contender for this kind of crazy question for somebody in our position.
I think your point about putting it on an alligator strap, which I hadn't considered, but it's also another good consideration when it comes to owning a one watch. And I've kind of thought about it for the ones on my list. But that notion of being able to wear it on a number of different kinds of straps, I think is kind of an important thing to think about, because changing the strap on a watch can really change the mood or the look of it. And I think if you're only going to be wearing that thing day in and day out, it's kind of fun to change straps from time to time.
How many watches could it actually be?
Yeah, right. Now, the Doxa that I mentioned might not quite fit that, because it looks good on rubber, looks good on a NATO, and certainly the beads of rice bracelet that it comes on. But I don't know about an alligator or even leather strap. Might look okay on leather.
Maybe.
But it's a sports watch through and through, so...
The lugs are kind of small for the shape of the case on the Doxa.
Yeah.
So if the strap isn't just right and it doesn't fill that gap correctly,
right,
it tends to make the strap look fairly small.
Yeah.
That's what I see on the vintage ones, is, you know, they'll be on kind of that popular two-stitch strap.
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't, it makes the case look bigger than it actually is.
Right.
Or maybe the lugs more narrow than they actually are. One or the other, I suppose. But yeah. That concept of trying to select a watch that could kind of be more than one watch,
mm-hmm.
brings me to my final choice, if we want to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So my final choice is a Rolex, and it's the GMT Master II, the 16710.
Mm-hmm.
So the previous generation.
Yeah.
And for me, this is essentially the perfect single watch. I don't necessarily like it any more than my Explorer II. But with the GMT 2, you get the same functionality, but the added use of a bezel. You have the option of two different bracelets. You could have it on the Oyster or on the Jubilee. You know, there's lots of guys online that have fitted Jubilees to these cases. And then you have three bezels. So you can very simply swap out between the Coke, the Pepsi, and the Black, which gives you a pretty wide range of watch. It looks amazing on a NATO. It looks great on a leather strap. The style is still very much keyed to what I think is one of the most beautiful watches, sport watches of all time, the 1675. So it's all very close, and I think it has the kind of perfect mix of what I would wear in a single watch forever, especially if I'm picking something that I don't already own.
Yeah.
And I really just love the 16710. It's basically three plus watches in one. It's never really going to look out of place. It's not too big. It's not too shiny. And I think it's a really gorgeous design with a really proven functionality. And it has kind of a background that I like. You know, it pops up in movies every now and then. John Milius wore one, which I really think is kind of fun. And you know, I just kind of dig the watch and its entire ethos. And I think that would be my selection. And the nice thing is that you can pretty much find them all day long for between $5,000 and $6,000 US.
Yeah.
In nice shape. And then, you know, go ahead and hunt down a few extra bezels. I actually see a lot of the guys selling them online have already done the bezel hunt for you. So they often come with another, either the other one or both of the other two.
Right.
And I just think it's an excellent watch. If you want to lean on one that might be worth a little bit more in the future, the 16710 was very briefly made with a 3186 movement. So the 3185 is the movement that was in the Explorer 2 and the 16710. And while the Explorer 2, like the one that I have, 16570, while the Explorer 2 had more than a year, I believe, of production with the 3186, which is the upgraded movement.
That's the one with the parachrome.
Correct. Yeah, the blue hairspring, and it's in the modern, the 16710 uses the 3186, but it was a very slim window, at least according to what I've read online. It was a very slim window for the 16710, you know, the standard 40 millimeter aluminum bezel style GMT Master II. There's a very thin window, so they're worth a little bit more. They're already selling more like $8,000 or $9,000 when I see them.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you wanted to go that route, you could consider trying to track one down that has the 3186 movement. If you wanted something a little bit more special than the, you know, quote unquote garden variety GMT Master II from that generation.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned the GMT Master. It was on my short list. It isn't my top pick, but it was definitely one of my top three. I had a 1675 for a while, loved it.
What
again,
a watch.
It was another one that got away. But it's an interesting story. I've got a little short story here. I was down in, this was, I don't know how many years ago, but I was down in, New Mexico, Roswell for the then aborted launch of Felix Baumgartner's Jump from the Edge of Space, that Red Bull.
Oh, sure.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a big media extravaganza and there were a lot of delays in the launch. And I was standing outside on the balcony of this press room that they had built. And there was this guy kind of standing out next to me. I don't know if he was having a smoke or on his phone or something. And I glanced down at his wrist and he had this really old beat up 1675 GMT Master on his wrist. And it was on the old riveted bracelet, all stretched out. The bezel was all faded, scratched up crystal, just really beat up. And I walked over, and this was when I still had mine. And I walked over and I kind of held out my wrist like watch geeks are known to do and said, nice watch. And we started talking about it and I asked him how long he'd had it and where he got it. And he took it off and he handed it to me and he said, turn it over. And I looked on the back and on the back engraved, it said, Kinshasa 1974. And he said, what do you think that means? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I know where Kinshasa is, but I don't know what the significance of that date is. And he said, he was a National Geographic film producer. And in 1974, he and a buddy decided to go off and be mercenaries or filmmakers or whatever they were doing at the time. He was a young man at the time. And they went off to Africa to just see what sort of trouble they could get into. And in 1974 in Kinshasa was when they had the famous boxing match between, I think it was Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. It was called the Rumble in the Jungle.
Wow.
One of the most famous boxing matches of all time. And he went to that fight. And it was at the time that he was in the city that he bought his GMT Master 1675 new and had it engraved on the back. And he's worn it ever since. That's the only watch he's ever owned. And
what a story.
It was such a great story. And I was so, well, for one thing, I was so moved by this story that I actually wrote an article on Hodinkee about it several years ago, and you can probably still find it. But it was that classic one watch guy that I've always wanted to be, you know, and yet I would never will be. And he will never be me because he's not a collector. He wanted one good quality watch that met his criteria and he's never taken it off his wrist. And he asked me at the end of our chat, he said, you know, it's running a little slow and the, you know, it's all scratched up. He said, I'm thinking about getting one of the new ones. And I was like, please don't, you know, I said, just get this serviced, you know, maybe get a new crystal, but just just wear this thing. It's such a beautiful thing, you know?
Yeah.
And again, here was a guy who was wearing perhaps, as you mentioned, the ultimate one watch. That story always sticks with me, and that watch, I think, stands out as definitely a one watch candidate. I'll quickly move to my kind of last two candidates, and they're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. And I don't know if I defied any rules here, but they're actually two watches that I own now. So if I had to, I'd have to whittle down between these two to get rid of everything else.
Okay.
One of them is our old favorite, the Seiko SRP 777. And I realize that this is a recent watch, you know, within the past year. It's an homage to the 6309 from the 70s or the 80s. But I just think if I look at all of my criteria, you know, ruggedness, screw-in crown, ease of service, it's uncomplicated, looks good on a lot of different straps, it's unobtrusive, it's not going to get, you know, I'm not going to get mugged for it, hopefully. And it's an interesting, it's a good-looking enough watch that I think I would enjoy it for many years to come. So I think a Seiko should be on most people's kind of short list for a one watch, at least by my judgment. I just think they, you know, everybody knows the legendary Seiko durability and everything else about it. So that's one of them. The other is the Rolex Submariner, the no date 14060, which is the watch that we talked about in our collection inspection episode a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
It's a watch that not only holds sentimental value for me, but I think there's something about the Submariner that, you know, as a passionate diver, it kind of, I think I would need a dive watch. And I think, despite the fact that it's so simple, it doesn't even have a date, which, you know, there's pros and cons to that. Having a Rolex on my wrist, that it has this built-in sort of legacy or history to it, that it almost, like, when I look at it, it gives me this intangible sort of motivation to get out and do stuff wearing a watch. Because I know that the watch can take it. I know that countless other people have climbed mountains and discovered, you know, treasure, sunken treasure, and done whatever else wearing these watches. And so there's this kind of intangible motivation that just wearing that watch gives me every time I look at it, that kind of gets me out of the sleeping bag on a cold morning or whatever. And I think...
Sure.
I think that is kind of the ultimate tipping point that pushes that watch over to be kind of the winner. And the one watch that... Fortunately, I already own, but if I truly had to get rid of everything else, that would be the one that stood standing at the end. So that's my winner.
That's great. So, I mean, we picked very, you know, largely sibling watches, and I think it's a testament to kind of what you've experienced with not only the sentimental value that you have in that Rolex in the Sub, but also in what you've experienced for its ability to kind of withhold the lifestyle that you feel you aspire to have.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I see in the GMT Master too. But it is interesting, you mentioned there right at the end that it would be the last one that you would sell.
Yeah.
See, that changes my math, because the last one I would sell is a Seiko, which will bring me back to your second to last choice. I have an SKX 007, yeah. And with no reservation, it would be the last watch I would get rid of. I would probably be homeless before I stopped. Had this watch, like, it just is not worth enough to make a change in the game if things went that poorly.
Yeah.
But I would sell my EXP with, you know, if I had to, I had to. It's fine. It's just a thing.
Yeah.
But much like you have some sentimental value in your Sub, there's some sentimental value for me in that SKX 07, and I think that it reminds me that regardless of what a watch costs, it's still very much a watch.
Yeah.
And you know, it's really easy in our position, I think in almost anybody's position who's really deep into this hobby, to start to see price as being fairly important, and prestige and branding and marketing and all of these things. And it's not that they aren't important or that they're all false, mm-hmm. but a watch that's as good as something like the SKX or the SRP at the price that they're offered does suggest there's a falsehood to a lot of what we accept as realities. And I say this realizing that we're two guys that just selected Rolexes as our kind of primary watch. Right. But I would be very much, you know, I have my SKX modded for a 12-hour bezel, mm-hmm. which I call a CMT, the cheap mean time. And I would be just as capable and happy to wear that watch around as I would the Rolex. I just feel the Rolex would be more special in the type in the watch category than something like an SKX, whereas the SKX would be for me more special in the sentimentality. And it sounds like you've got a mix of those two things together in the sub. So it's interesting how the brain kind of works, because none of this is rational. It's not rational to have a bunch of watches, and it's not rational to be somebody that wants a bunch of watches and has to consider only one. It's all kind of silly if you zoom out enough. But if you don't, if you remain kind of at operating length, I think it's interesting that the decisions that we came to and how it really does come down to these watches that have an adventurous spirit and still reflect the kind of nerdy element of liking watches, all wrapped up into one. So whether it's a Seiko at $200 or $300 or a Rolex at, let's say, between $4,000 and $5,000 and $6,000, I don't think it necessarily changes the enthusiasm. It just kind of changes the metric by which it's viewed.
I agree. And I'd be curious, you know, as we kind of wrap this up, I think it's a topic that it's the classic, you know, barroom watch nerd conversation.
Yeah, it's the like, three car garage question or whatever you've got. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And so, you know, Scott, thanks a lot for that question. I think, you know, it inspired us to talk for passionately here for well over, you know, probably half an hour. So, you know, really great. And we'd love to hear from our listeners as to maybe what their choices would be, whether they agree with us or they have other watches that they would consider as their one and only, or if it's one that they're seeking. Let us know, you know, tag the Grey NATO on Instagram or email us at thegreynato@gmail.com and let us know what is your one watch.
Yeah. And if you've managed to actually go to one watch, be very interested to get a little essay from you. So send us an email or throw it up on Instagram. If you're listening to this and you're holding your phone right now, jump to the episode 12 post for the Grey NATO on at the Grey NATO and just throw in the comments of what you would pick and maybe what you think about our selections. Thank you so much, Scott, for the question, and we'll be back in just a moment with new business. And we're back. We really hope that you liked the first main segment about our kind of one watch conundrum, but we're ready to get into new business. So Jason, what do you got this week? What's new? What's happening?
Well, I have moving far away from the one watch conundrum because I just acquired another watch.
It's a killer too.
It's a killer. Yeah. So I was in, as I mentioned last episode, I was in down in Bonaire doing some diving a few weeks ago. And between dives, I'm sitting on the balcony of the apartment that we were renting, and I'm checking my email, and this one pops up from a guy, a vintage dealer in Chicago, and he says, I've got a couple of watches you might be interested in. And one of them was a Doxa Sub-200 Sea Rambler T-Graph, and it was a watch that I've long loved, but they're such unicorns. I mean, they're just so rare. They just don't pop up for sale. And I always assumed they were way out of my price range. So when this popped up, I almost impulsively wrote back and said, I'll take it. And I, as luck would have it, I had just sold a car that I'd had for a long time, had a little bit of cash, and pulled the trigger. And I had to wait like agonizing like 10 long days before I got back from that trip and another trip. And then finally it came in the mail, and I really haven't taken it off since. I think it's like a 69 or 70. So it's, you know, 45, 46 years old. The Sea Rambler is the silver dial that Doxa made. And the T-Graph denotes that it's a two register chronograph, hand wound. It's got the classic Doxa case and the no deco bezel, but it's got a really interesting movement in it. It's like, it was made by Eberhard, and it's a hand wound column wheel chronograph with date, which was a fairly rare combination back then.
Yeah.
But Eberhard was kind of under the same umbrella of companies at the time. Must have been Synchron during that era. And Doxa sourced the movement from them and made it. And apparently they only made 300 of the three different colors, the orange dial, the black dial, and the silver dial. And this one happens to be the silver, which I think I kind of like the most.
I also think it's the best of the three. And for anyone listening, zip over to Jason's Instagram, at Jason Heaton, and check out some pictures, because I actually don't think, unless you know the watch already that it's going to be exactly what you think it is. It's really cool.
Yeah.
It has this really cool minute hand, and it's a killer design, and I think the silver dial is definitely the one to have.
Yeah, I love it. And it came with the original bracelet, which if you don't know about the old Doxa bracelets, they were way ahead of their time. It's the beads of rice style bracelet, but then it has this clasp that when you pop it open, it has the little ratchet teeth inside the clasp and a little spring-loaded tooth that grips the ratchet teeth, so that when you open it, it opens all the way and you can take it off. But then when you put it on, you close the clasp and you squeeze the bracelet, and it closes up to exactly the fine-tuned diameter that you want. And then it also has, on each end of the clasp, it has these spring-loaded sections that are made to expand if you wear it over a wetsuit sleeve. And it's just the most ingenious bracelet. I mean, we talk about the Tudor Pelagos bracelet nowadays and how great it is. It's essentially this solves the same issues, you know, 45 years earlier. I mean, it's just a...
So cool. I had no idea when you told me that there was any of that functionality in the old Doxa bracelets.
Yeah.
And it's just awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm smitten. It's a great watch.
I can't wait to see it when you get up here in July. It's going to be a highlight of the trip.
I will bring it up. I will not take it diving, though.
Fair enough.
Just a quick further update. I just got back a few days ago. I was in out in Colorado. I know, James, you've got a mountain trip coming up. I was out there with my wife. We were there for 4 days, flew out to Denver, and then drove out to Boulder and did 4 days of some pretty intensive hiking. We did kind of an acclimatizing hike around the Flatirons, which are just the kind of the mountain range right behind Boulder. And then the next day we drove out to Rocky Mountain National Park, went through Estes Park, went into the park entrance, and we did a few-hour hike up to Emerald Lake, which is a beautiful alpine lake that's surrounded by these big craggy peaks. You got Hallett Peak on one side and Flat Top Mountain on the other. Tops out at about 10,000 feet at the end of the trail there, and we had some lunch there, and the marmots were chasing us around trying to steal food from us, and it was just a beautiful sunny day. There was still snow up there, and then the last day that we were there, actually it wasn't the last day, the second to last day, we tackled a peak called Deer Mountain, which kind of a moderate peak as Rocky Mountain National Park goes. I mean, you can go up to, you know, 14,200 plus on a few of the peaks out there. Deer Mountain tops out a little over 10,000 feet, but it's a beautiful hike. We left really early in the morning, and we pretty much had the mountain to ourselves. And when we got to the top, it has these beautiful vistas out over Long's Peak and some of the other 14ers out there. If anyone's looking for a kind of a good sort of moderate hike that you can do in a half a day in Rocky Mountain National Park, I really strongly recommend Deer Mountain. It was really a fun hike. So, you know, with all the diving lately, it was just great to get out and get in the mountains and do some hiking.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and you've got some mountain travel, mountain climbing coming up soon, James. Too. What's coming up for you?
Yeah. So this would be the last episode we'll record before Baker. So I'm off to northern Washington. It's just a relatively short drive from where I live in Vancouver, and a pretty nicely laid out kind of 3 days on the mountain via Easton Glacier, and will be the culmination of kind of my first attempt to plan out and get ready for physically and gear wise an actual alpine ascent. And I know I've talked at length about this on the show in the past, so I'll keep it as brief as possible with that. I'm also working on a local Vancouver collector's Ferrari collection. So this is a gentleman that actually has all five of Ferrari's supercars. So I'm going to write that up for Monte Cristo magazine here in Vancouver. But yeah, it's a gentleman that has a 288 GTO, an F40, an F50, an Enzo, and a LaFerrari.
Oh my gosh.
All red and all really, really cool.
Wow.
So I'm excited about that. You know, the 288 GTO is one of my all-time favorite cars from one of my favorite eras of cars. And so that's fun. You know, it's one that just kind of dropped on my lap and I'm pretty excited about. I also found out just earlier today that I have a Raven Defender coming in for review. So Raven is one of the kind of sister brands to Steve Rao, previously Benares watches. And the Defender was done through a Kickstarter campaign. So it's this kind of cool field watch design with these two oversized crowns. Came in a bunch of different versions as per the usual for Kickstarter. But it's one of these ones where you get a chance at a very nice price point via the Kickstarter. So that's one that I'm kind of excited to check out. You know, it's just a few hundred dollars. Seems pretty fair. And I think it's a pretty cool design. I'm not sure how the big crowns will wear in person. But that's the fun of doing a review. Certainly from the photos, I like the style of the watch. Finally, you know, I've been dragging my heels on this one, and a couple people have actually mentioned it on Instagram, but I am writing my SRP 777 review, so I won't continue to drag my heels on that. It'll be a full video, so if you've been waiting for that, or it feels like too long since you read everybody else's reviews of that watch, I've started writing it, and I will complete it sometime in the near future. Just stay tuned, and I'll put that link up when it's available.
Nice. Hey, what watch are you going to wear on Baker, and more importantly, what strap is going to keep it on your wrist?
Yeah, so Baker, I'm taking the Explorer. I didn't buy an Explorer to baby it. I feel like it's the proper watch for the trip. And I picked up a new, this is going to sound like we're sponsored or in any way paid by Toxic, but we really aren't, I promise. I'd just rather dig his straps. And I placed an order there for a new strap, which they call the Toxic Royal. And it's kind of these RAF, or I know it as kind of a Maritac style. So it's NATO-esque in that it's a piece of nylon, you know, a piece of webbing. But it's a single piece, so there's no underkeeper, and then there's no metal keepers at all. It has a single loop of nylon to function as a keeper for the tail. And then it has a simple sewn-in metal loop, so there's no point of failure on the watch. And it'll make sure that the EXP is as close to my wrist as possible and that there's nothing that could break and result in me dropping the watch or losing it. And it should hopefully keep it from binding up, you know, with no metal edges or anything from binding up on any of the various sleeves that I'll be wearing throughout the trip. So I bought one in unsurprisingly gray. And I only got it this afternoon and I threw it on the watch immediately, and it kind of suits the smaller size and proportions of the Explorer. It works nicely. And if you're not one for a NATO, or you prefer not to have the hardware maybe clicking on your desk or your keyboard or the face of your laptop or something like that, then I mean, this is a kind of a cool option. And for the utmost in safety and simplicity, I think it's cool. They're $12. It seems pretty fair. They often have promo codes going on these days, so you can check these out. And just to prove that again, I'm not being paid by Toxic in any way. The Broad Arrow guys also sell the Maritac ones through their site, and I have had one of those for a few years, and it's held up really well. It's my go-to gray 22 millimeter option. So it feels like a good time to move on to Q&A. And as we have an interview later in the show, we're going to go with one longer Q&A question rather than our normal two. So for today's question and answer, we have Max in Colorado, and he wrote in with a very specific question, and I would quickly apologize to Max because he wrote some time ago, and because of the complexity of his question, it took us some time to get to it, but I think we've got a full answer for you, Max, so I apologize for being tardy, but here we go. Max says, I spend most of my free time fly fishing in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. Awesome. Thunderstorms are a daily occurrence during the summertime, so I'm looking for a chronograph with a telemeter scale to accurately calculate the distance from a lightning strike and better judge when it's time to seek shelter. There are a few telemeter chronographs on the market from Alpina and Longines. The problem is that they all have a polished cases and reflective crystals. Shiny watches, or shiny anything, tend to spook fish, especially in the small mountain streams I frequent. I'd love to hear your thoughts on a telemeter chronograph with a stealthy case and a double AR-coated crystal. If there's nothing currently available, I'd love some advice on modding the case or crystal or adding a telemeter scale to the dial or bezel of an existing stealthy watch. I'd prefer an automatic movement, but quartz could work. So, Jason, what do you think for Max's very cool, very specific question?
Yeah, this kind of question, I mean, it was tough for us. I know we went back and forth for several weeks on this, but It's actually the kind of question I love. I love watches that are actually used for stuff, of course. I think we both do, but especially such a niche purpose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just having been out in Colorado, I know that those thunderstorms roll in pretty much every day, right around midday, and you got to get out of the lightning strike area. So I've got two watches that are kind of on opposite ends of the price and style spectrums, but I think, other than the crystal reflectivity, which I'm not quite sure about, I think they might meet your criteria. One is a bit of an outlier, a bit of a bold one, and that is the Graham Chronofighter Navy SEALs Foundation. This, you know, Graham is just, they're out there. They're big watches. They're big, you know, masculine, kind of in-your-face watches with the giant left-side bomb trigger push button for the chronograph. But, you know, from what I've seen, they're well-made watches. It's an ETA 7750-based chronograph movement. The thing about the Navy SEALs Foundation version is it has sort of this subtle digital camo dial, which is very sort of polarizing. Some people might hate it. Some people might like it. Maybe as an outdoorsman, you might gravitate towards it. But it's got a PVD steel case. Looks to be a matte finish from what I can see. Rubber strap. And then it has a telemeter on the dial that's calibrated in miles, which is, I think, helpful, at least here in the States, the only place in the world that seems to still use miles, and to 77 degrees Fahrenheit, which telemeters are used to track the speed of sound, and the speed of sound is dependent on air temperature. And the fact that they specified 77 degrees and they're doing it in miles, I think, is kind of an interesting twist. Might lend itself fairly well to your situation, although that big bomb trigger push button might get snagged on your jacket or something. On the other end of the spectrum is a Victorinox Swiss Army, which I've always liked. I love the brand. And they had a watch called the Infantry Vintage that they made in PVD for a while. And it was a matte finish PVD. And it's a quartz chronograph with three registers. But it has a pretty prominent telemeter scale on the dial. And I think it would just make a kind of one of those ideal outdoor watches. You know, quartz, it's going to be rugged, not too expensive. They're slightly right around the $800 mark. And I'm not sure that it's still in their current catalog. I kind of had a hard time finding the PVD version on their website, but I'm sure you can pick one up secondhand from one of the online dealers or just look around for it used. But, the Graham was, like I said, it's a limited edition, bit of an outlier, fairly expensive. The Swiss Army might be a good, I think it'd be just a kind of a cool fishing watch. It kind of has that vibe to it too. So those are my two recommendations. James, what did you come up with?
Well, along with your recommendations, I would say you could consider the Ball Fireman Storm Chaser. So this is a watch designed quite specifically for these sorts of uses, more for tracking and following storms, hypothetically. But this is a steel chronograph with the telemeter scale, and I think it's quite a handsome watch. I believe the watch has a mixed surface, so if it was absolutely if this was the watch that you wanted and it was crucial that it not have any polished, I think it has a polished banding along the lug edge. You could theoretically have that brushed out. Another option beyond the ball to go in an entirely different direction is this strange Seiko. And so this is the Seiko SNN021P1, which I was able to find kind of randomly through Google image search. It's a simple sort of integrated bracelet style entry level Seiko quartz. It's around $100 US and it features a telemeter scale. So, I mean, if that's what you wanted, that would be at a price point where if you did want to modify it, get it brushed, get it bead blasted or something like that, if it had some, you know, more polish than was acceptable, that would be an option. And theoretically, you can have the crystals coated to be more anti-reflective if that's an issue with a watch of that price point. And then the last ones that I could find, I don't think they're going to suit kicking around outside in the, you know, in the stream, in the wilderness. But the company Hanhart makes a couple of watches with telemeter scales. They're fairly spendy. But you can swing by the show notes to see a link to a couple options from there. So, I mean, it's a fairly precise question, and I think that Swiss Army vintage PVD that Jason spoke about is probably right on the line with just about ideal for that sort of use. And I mean, if you can source one, you can probably score a pretty solid price as well. So thanks very much for that question, Max, and I hope the lightning season and fishing season serves you well, and whatever you find on wrist, I hope it works out. If you have your question, please send it to us, thegraynado@gmail.com, or you can write us directly on Instagram if you prefer, @thegraynado. I'm reading all the emails. I'm replying to as many as possible. We have a fantastic collection of questions, so if you want to get yours in there, by all means, send us an email. We really enjoy getting to know people who are listening to the show and trying to help you find a watch or a solution or something really specific, like with Max and his awesome question. Jason, you sat down with a pretty interesting guest. Tell us about it, and we'll get to it.
Yeah, this week I had a chance to have a phone chat with Hamilton Powell, who is the CEO of Crown & Caliber, which, if you've been paying any attention online, on the forums, or on social media, you might know that name. Crown & Caliber is an Atlanta-based seller of pre-owned watches, and they've got a pretty unique take on the selling process and how they do consignment of watches. And Hamilton was a really interesting guy to talk to. He's very passionate about watches and just a fun guy to talk to. And he has some interesting opinions about vintage pieces, pre-owned stuff, even the Apple Watch. So give it a listen. I'm speaking with Hamilton Powell, CEO of Atlanta-based Crown & Caliber, which is one of the leading online sellers of pre-owned watches. Hamilton, welcome to the Graynado, and thanks for speaking with me today.
Likewise, thank you.
Can you, first of all, before we kind of launch into the nitty-gritty of what Crown & Caliber does, maybe we can get a little background on you. What's your history with watches, and how did it kind of lead you to get involved launching or backing Crown & Caliber?
Sure. So my background is actually in the financial space. So before Crown & Caliber, I ran a private equity investment fund. And it was really through observation that I got into Crown & Caliber. Ever since I can remember, my dad wore a really great Rolex Datejust. And so it's probably the story that a lot of men have of their dad's watch and how special it really is.
Yeah.
And so as long as I can remember, just being a little kid, he'd always have that on his wrist. But what really kind of, I guess, started Crown & Caliber was a conversation I had with a friend of mine over lunch. His name was Jay. And Jay's a great guy. And he was telling me this horror story of how he was selling his Patek Philippe watch. And he told me the story that I found later on to be pretty typical of a lot of people. He started off by listing it on eBay. And he got all sorts of interesting responses to that listing, like, you know, please send the watch to my cousin in Nigeria, who will then send you funds. and then that obviously didn't work. So then he posted on Craigslist, but then the idea of meeting somebody in a parking lot with his Patek Philippe watch just wasn't something that settled well with him.
Yeah.
So he did what most people do, is he spent a Saturday afternoon just driving around to a bunch of retail stores and getting a bunch of lowball offers, and then he ended up taking one of those offers. I think it was $5,200 is what he sold it for as a gondola. It was really just kind of sad. But wow. He then went back to that store a few weeks later for some other reason. He saw his exact watch for sale for $12,000.
Oh,
and so it's just this idea that, you know, it's just such an inefficient secondary marketplace. And so after that conversation, I figured that there's got to be a better way to make this secondary watch marketplace efficient and more customer friendly, just not just to the buyer, but also to the seller.
Yeah. Huh. So how long has Crown & Caliber been in business?
We started the company a little over 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. Oh, you guys have grown fast. You've got a big presence these days. Yeah.
We have, and that's, we've been really fortunate just to have some really great customers and obviously great people here. We started with an idea and just a couple folks, and now we're approaching, I think, 50 full-time employees now.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Anyway. So kind of getting back to your history, you know, you mentioned your father's Datejust. What was kind of the first watch that really spoke to you? A few episodes ago, James and I had an episode that I think we called Origin Stories, and we talked about watches that kind of our first watches, both
you know, for me, it was a Seiko dive watch when I was in high school, and then kind of moved up the ladder to like a Planet Ocean at some point, and some others over the years. But do you recall, you know, kind of either the first watch maybe you wore as a kid, or maybe your first legitimate kind of luxury watch?
Yeah. So before Crown and Caliber, I really, you know, just was at an age and stage where I couldn't afford a great watch, to be honest. And it was since starting it that I got exposed to some really great watches, but more importantly, got exposed to some really great thinkers in the watch space. The one that I would point to most is Jeff Stein at you know, he runs On the Dash.
Oh yeah.
And Jeff was the one that introduced me to Hoyer, and he is the one that is responsible for my ridiculous spending habit now on Hoyers. And so my first great watch that I got was an Abercrombie & Fitch Seafarer.
Oh, nice.
That Jeff helped me to identify. And so that's the one that means the most to me, just because, as you know, I mean, that first watch is that yeah. first great watch especially
yeah.
is just always so important.
Yeah. You said your father had a Datejust. Was he into watches? I mean, is he kind of a mentor in watch appreciation, or was it just he had the Datejust because so many people got a Datejust when they kind of got a promotion or something?
Yeah, he got that watch when he was, I guess it was their fifth wedding anniversary. My mom and my dad have been married for, I think, 35 years now. So that was when he got it. So he's had that watch forever.
Yeah.
And so I think the importance of the watch isn't that it's some incredible, complicated watch. It's just a, you know, it's a Datejust. But mm-hmm. the thing that's, I think, more important about that watch is, you know, it's my dad's watch.
Yeah.
It's the watch that he wore to every baseball game, every practice, every memory I have of him.
Yeah.
He's wearing that watch.
since you started Crown & Caliber, has he, what does he make of the work you're doing? Does he appreciate it? Has he gotten into watches further?
He's had his watch repaired several times and cleaned several times, complimentary, I can tell you that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So he's enjoyed the fringe benefits of having a son in the watch space, for sure.
But he's one of those mythical one watch guys, would you
yep.
say?
Yeah. He is, oh, yeah. Man. And he hasn't looked to collect anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Good for him. I kind of envy guys like that to a certain degree.
I do too, given the amount of money that I've spent on my collection. So,
yeah, right.
And honestly, I think, you know, collecting isn't about the number that you have. You know, I think it's about just having the right ones, the ones that mean the most to you. So I think as I've, you know, grown my collection, it's not just having a bunch of watches, it's having ones that mean something. And I'm sure you're the same way, that
yeah.
that you want to collect for a passion,
yeah.
not for a number.
Right. What would you say? I mean, there's such a, I think, you know, you guys have kind of came in at just the perfect time, because there's such a resurgent interest, or maybe it's a new interest in collecting vintage watches. I mean, it's, you know, you can see the, just in the past 5 to 7 years, the number of resellers has gone up. There's, you know, big jumps in prices, these massive auction results that we see reported almost weekly. What do you attribute to this recent boom in vintage watches, given the state of the timepiece being obsolete these days?
Yeah, you know, we're seeing, so I would classify the watches that we deal with as pre-owned or vintage. Mm-hmm. And pre-owned has a little bit more of a modern bent to it.
Yeah.
Whereas vintage is, you know, kind of anything from the 80s and earlier, but although that's debatable, but I think what you're referring to is vintage in and of itself. But we've actually seen a resurgence in both. I think I can speak to the general pre-owned market first, and yeah. And what we've really seen happen is I think the consumer is getting smarter, and as the world has become more global and more transparent, so too has become known the true cost of buying something brand new.
Yeah.
And I think that the average consumer realizes that when they go to a retail store, they're paying for the chandelier. They're paying for the marble floor. And
yeah.
as we have and others have made the secondary watch market more efficient and more trusted, you know, that gap is no longer necessary between pre-owned and it's kind of like what's been done in the luxury car space. Certified pre-owned is now an adopted way of buying a luxury car, and that's what we're trying to do in the watch space, is just to take the trust issue out and make it so that you can get essentially the same watch for up to 50% off of retail. The vintage market, which is what your original question was about, is absolutely on fire. I mean, you see it every day. You see it in the auction world. You see it with a lot of resellers coming out, And honestly, I think there's a couple things that I would attribute to that. One, I think is general men's fashion trends are kind of going in the direction of the old Cary Grant days.
Yeah.
I think I think that that's really one of the reasons why men like a lot of these watches is because it appeals to the general fashion trend that's going on right now. But I also think that just having been in it now for a little over 3 years, seeing the amount of publicity that's been generated on the vintage watches, I think a lot of people just didn't know about these cool watches. Americans are individualistic people to start off with.
Yeah.
And I think that it just really resonates with people that they can have a watch that nobody else has. And that's the same reason everybody puts bumper stickers on their cars.
Yeah.
We don't really want to be the same. And I think having a watch that has a story and a history unlike anything else is one of the reasons why people like them. So yeah. I think there's a couple reasons.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that's a good point too. I think there's a lot more information out there nowadays. I mean, it was only, you know, when I started writing for Hodinkee, for instance, it was like 2010, I think. I mean, it's only 6 years ago. Granted, there were certainly blogs before that, you know, a blog to watch and a few others, and of course the web forums. But it's only really been in the past decade, I would say, that this huge amount of information that a person could just sit at his desk if he's bored at work and learn everything there is to know about an Abercrombie and Fitch Seafarer, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd also think that the brands are partially to blame for the resurgence in vintage only because look what they're doing. They're doing so many reissues. They're doing so many, so much embracing of their past that it kind of forces the consumer to explore that past.
Yeah.
And when they explore the past, I think what they find is I can have the original vintage version of this watch.
Yeah.
In some cases for less than the modern reissue. So why would I not want that vintage version instead? So anyway, I think that's kind of an interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, we both probably realize that the pre-owned and vintage collecting can be a bit of a minefield. I mean, there's obviously authenticity issues and quality, you know, service history, all this kind of stuff. I guess I've got a two-part question. What sorts of watches or what criteria does Crown & Caliber apply when it's assessing a watch to take on a consignment basis for somebody? I mean, you obviously don't just take anything. And then also kind of what's the process that you guys go through to authenticate it and service it?
Sure. So let me pretend you're selling your watch and just kind of walk you through the process. I think that might help answer your question. So if you have a watch to sell, you have a lot of options. You can go on eBay or Craigslist or try to sell it yourself. But we present, I think, a pretty compelling option for individuals. So it starts by going to our website and entering just a little bit of information about your watch into our quote form. And so once you hit submit, that information goes to our team of valuation experts. So we have five individuals here that do nothing but determine the value of the watches that we're selling.
Mm-hmm.
And so we then get back to you and say, hey, thanks for the quote submission. Here's the data we have on your watch. And we'll actually present to you the last 10 or 20 times your watch is sold at auction or on eBay or on forums or what we've sold it for. And we'll actually arm you with that data.
Huh.
So we'll say, based on this data, we believe we can sell your watch for, say, $10,000. And if you like that number, then what we'll do is we'll ship you prepaid and insured packaging materials at our expense, so it's totally free to you.
Mm-hmm.
Those materials arrive at your front door, and then you just wrap up your watch, and you send it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get your watch in our secure facilities, that's kind of when, to your question about adding value, that's when we add value.
Yeah.
So we'll take your watch, we'll do a 45-point inspection on it, and if it needs some service, we'll do the service. We have 6 full-time watchmakers here under our roof. And so we'll service that watch if it needs servicing. We'll then refinish it if it's a modern watch and it deserves some polishing or refinishing. And then we will professionally photograph your watch and get it on our site. And we'll probably list it a little bit higher than the $10,000 to try to get you as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But your watch will then sell. Typically, our watches sell within 60 days, and we will not sell it for a penny less than that $10,000 number that we promised you.
Huh.
And then From the buyer's standpoint, though, what they're doing is they're buying a certified pre-owned watch from Crown & Caliber that's gone through our 45-point inspection process, serviced by our watchmakers, and they can buy it with confidence because we offer a full-year warranty on our watches. And honestly, if something goes wrong, we're here. I mean, we've got a reputation. We're not a fly-by-night dealer. Mm-hmm. So we'll do whatever it takes to make you happy as a buyer. So really what we're trying to do is to make it easy for sellers and make it a trustworthy experience for buyers.
Sure. And is the, going back to kind of the criteria part of it, will you take pretty much anything? I mean, within reason. You know, there are a lot of watches that I don't want to offend anybody, but let's say it was a Movado museum watch that, you know, was very popular in the 80s, kind of a quartz Movado museum watch. I mean, they aren't particularly sought after these days. Would you take a, I don't want to use that watch in particular, but you know, there are a lot of watches that are just either out of fashion or not as desirable. And of course, it's in your interest to sell these watches. So do you ever say no or turn things away?
We do. We actually say no about 50% of the time. And, oh. and it's for that reason. There's mainly two reasons why we would say no. One is the price. Our unit economics require that the watch be worth at least $2,000. Mm-hmm. So for that Movado museum watch or for other watches, Timexes or Casios or, you know, things like that, even some Tag Heuers, mm-hmm. that would fall below that $2,000. We go to the owner and we kindly and graciously tell them, I'm sorry, this is just not the right way to sell the watch.
Yeah.
The second reason we would say no is if the watch required a complete overhaul. In that case, it's just not worth our time and energy to do that. And so make it really, really difficult to put all that time and energy and to actually sell it profitably. So those are typically the two reasons. Although I will tell you that most watches that come in that actually pass our price criteria, if they do require some service, we typically can do that in-house.
Sure. Kind of going to your own collection, without getting into specifics, I would imagine in your position, you pretty much have the pick of the litter. I mean, it must be very difficult to kind of control your own urges to not just keep adding to your own collection from the stuff that comes in from prospective sellers on Crown & Caliber. I mean, what's your kind of filter for your own collection?
Yeah, first of all, it's like Christmas every day over here.
Sure.
You kind of get, you know, you get the FedEx guy coming with these big roll carts and lots of packages every single day. So the discipline for me is really simple, is I don't meddle in the day-to-day watches. Otherwise, it completely puts me in the worst potential conflict of interest with our consigners.
Yeah.
So really I leave my collecting to myself in my spare time. And so working with, you know, people like Jeff or, you know, some of the industry leaders, mm-hmm. in the space, you know, going online and trying to find something. I try to stay away from our own watches just for that conflict.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
If you could give some advice to maybe an earlier version of yourself, maybe before Crown & Caliber, what would it be, and kind of how far back would you go, whether it's you know, watch related or otherwise? I mean, what lessons have you learned?
That's an interesting question. From a personal standpoint, you know, I think the advice I would give, say, you know, college Hamilton, if mm-hmm. you will,
yeah.
is you really aren't in that much control.
Yeah.
And you can fill in the blank, whether that's in business, in life, whatever. So I think what that does is that creates this great sense of freedom in a lot of ways, that the decisions we make, yes, while they're important, ultimately, we're not as in control as we think.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, from a personal standpoint, I think that's been a really, you know, just a big lesson learned. Mm-hmm. From a business standpoint, I would say, and we've been fortunate enough to do this, but it took us probably longer than we should, is if you bring on great people and you focus on the customer experience, mm-hmm. those two things are all that really matters. And so having great people here and just focusing really hard on the customer experience.
Yeah.
You do those two things well, I don't care what business you're in, you'll succeed.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's interesting. You talk about the staff you have. I think you said you have close to 50 people. I'm in Minneapolis, so I'm not in an exactly in a hotbed of of the watch culture. I mean, we'd like to think so, but you know, New York is obviously the center of the universe in the US when it comes to the watch business. How is it that you've built this up in Atlanta? I mean, that you've kind of drawn, nothing against Atlanta, but it doesn't seem like you would exactly have a huge pool of kind of watch experts or watchmakers down there to draw from. What was, I mean, I'm guessing you're from there, but what kind of, how did you grow the business in Atlanta?
Well, our benefits program includes grits and peaches, so we think that's really helped to bring on great talent. Yeah, you're right. It's difficult to attract great talent outside of New York or Silicon Valley or hotbeds like that.
Yeah.
You know, we've been able to do it. I really think it's because of the culture that we built over here. It's the most amazing culture of any company I've ever been a part of, and I think that when people come in the interview, they feel that and they sense it.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. Obviously, you know, we pay our employees well. We have great incentive programs and you know, things like that. I think that matters too. But the area of our company where that's been the hardest to grow has been our watchmakers.
Oh, yeah.
There's probably as many watchmakers in Atlanta as there are in Minneapolis. You know?
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, they're all in either Dallas or New York or, you know, other you know, kind of hotbeds like that around the mainly around the schools.
Yeah.
So we've had to work really hard to find watchmakers who, one, are talented, and two, are willing to move to Atlanta. And our watchmakers in particular are very unique in the sense that they have to know how to work on a Patek 2526 one morning, and then the afternoon working on a modern Panerai. You know,
yeah,
and
so yeah,
these
right.
these are not watchmakers that, you know, really just came from an assembly line background, but they have to have just years and years of experience. So we
yeah.
spend a lot of time doing that, and we have a full-time recruiter that helps us with that. So
wow,
you know, yeah.
Do you outsource any of the service work? Or you must, right? I mean, for some pieces, you just simply can't do them in-house, I would guess, right?
Yeah, and so that's why we turn away some watches that require just a massive amount of work that we couldn't do in-house. And we know enough to know when to say no.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, part of our growth has been having that discipline to say no when we need to.
Yeah.
We certainly have worked with some of the manufacturers to send them watches when we know we should, because ultimately we are a fiduciary to the consignor.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can be very upfront and honest with them and say we feel more comfortable if Patek did this work or if somebody did that work. And so we can certainly make that happen as well.
Yeah, right. So, you know, switching gears a little bit, I mean, you guys have really done a nice job with kind of social media promotion. I think it was last year, was a part of your curator program. We did sort of a dive watch thing on Instagram. How important do you think things like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook are to the watch business these days?
Well, I think it's really important for certain segments. I think it's irrelevant for other segments. So, you know, 93% of our customers, our last survey showed, are men. And but the ages range from anywhere from 20 to 80. And so so we're not as focused as a lot of other industries are, because there's an interest in watches that spans generations. And so certainly for the younger generation, social media is important. I think it certainly adds a legitimizing factor. But watches are—they're really unlike any other asset I've seen from a social standpoint. People just love to look at watches.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's really important, particularly for the younger generation, to do that. I think for the older generation, you know, more traditional advertising and things like that are kind of what they look to. But we're big believers in social. I think you know, it means a big deal to us.
Yeah. Do you think that there's any sort of a bubble in the current situation when it comes to pre-owned or vintage watch sales? Or do you think it's just a market that's expanding kind of into its rightful size at this point? Or do you think there will be a bubble and it'll kind of subside a little bit in the coming years?
Well, for modern pre-owned, I'd say no, it's not a bubble. In fact, I think it's just moving up, because that gap between our certified pre-owned watches and the retail equivalent
Yeah.
is still a huge gap. And so I think what we'll see is that gap continue to get smaller and smaller. Again, similar to certified pre-owned Mercedes or certified pre-owned Lexus. I think it's a similar kind of approach. So I think we'll continue to see a big interest in that, and the result will be that gap should get smaller and smaller.
Sure.
For vintage, I think it's clear there is a bubble right now. I don't know if it's going to burst or not. I could argue either way. I think personally, I think these vintage watches are worth the prices that we're seeing right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are one of a kind, really great watches.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, I think that this isn't necessarily a bubble, but it's just a it's just an awakening that these watches should be worth this price.
Yeah.
You should be able to. I mean, vintage hoarders, you know, I think are at the front of this bubble we're seeing. But I actually think these watches are worth that. And so, and a lot of people I think agree. So I don't know that we'll necessarily see a cooling down, but I do think that the continued hockey stick is probably going to start to plateau a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. What are there any brands or particular watches that you feel are maybe undervalued or will have their moment at some point? I mean, maybe you don't want to reveal that at this point as a collector, you know, sometimes you want to kind of keep that a secret so that you can scrape up as many as you can before they do take off. I mean, I have my own opinions. I happen to think I agree with a few other people in the industry that the Doxa, vintage Doxas, are kind of going to have their moment at some point. Any brands or watches that you feel are kind of undervalued or underappreciated?
Yeah, I would agree with you on the Doxas. I think you know, the NSRs too, we're starting to see a little bit of that same kind of Hoyer-esque momentum. I think I'd love to hear your thoughts on just Rolex in general. I think, you know, we've seen that that maybe plateau a little bit, although I'm not really confident on that statement, but
yeah.
It just seems like they may have plateaued a little bit.
Yeah.
I think UG still has a way to go. There's some really cool watches there.
Yeah.
And also, I know this may sound kind of weird, but I think vintage Tissot's.
Oh.
I think like they are one of the most undervalued, cool looking watch.
Yes.
And so, you know, anyway, that'd be kind of my, you know, look, if I just contributed to making the watches I love unachievable, then sorry.
Yeah.
But I think those are kind of the brands that,
sure.
that I certainly see. So anyway.
Sure. All right. Two more questions. Do you own an Apple Watch?
I do own an Apple Watch, but here's why.
Uh-huh.
Is because we did a really cool blog. I actually bought an Apple Watch for the sole purpose of giving it to my watchmaker.
Yes.
So he would open it up and disassemble it. and then I had him open up and disassemble a Breguet.
Yeah.
And I took pictures of the two.
Oh, nice.
And because I just wanted to show the guts of an Apple Watch versus the guts of a Breguet.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So technically, yes.
Yeah.
I do wear an Apple Watch, but it is in pieces right now. So there you go.
So last question. What watch are you wearing at the moment as we're speaking?
Right now I'm wearing a Hoyer Carrera, vintage Hoyer.
Nice.
Carrera. So
is that kind of your go-to piece, or do you?
Well, it is today. I just put it on. It came in and I just loved it. So I'm not owning it, but I'm wearing it right before it goes to photography this afternoon.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's great. Well, Hamilton Powell, thanks a lot for taking the time to chat with me today, and appreciate your support, and thanks a lot and all the best.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Well, once again, I want to thank Hamilton Powell and Crown & Caliber for sitting down for that interview with us. Really enjoyed speaking with you, Hamilton, and thanks a lot for being an enthusiastic listener of the show. Let's move right into our final notes to wrap up today's episode. James, what have you got for us?
Well, as I was preparing for my upcoming zip-up Baker, I broke my Princeton Tech headlamp, and like you said, better at home than on the hill. But I broke it, so I went out, I did a little bit of research, and I went out and got another one. I didn't want the Princeton. It seemed a little bit fiddly, and it had like a kind of a mechanical style switch that didn't seem especially protected, and certainly a very small drop. It was actually just in the lid of my backpack, and when I folded the lid over, the lid hit the table that was behind my backpack, and that broke the switch on the side of the headlamp. So wanting something kind of straightforward, I went with the kind of best reviewed option out there, which is the Black Diamond Spot. So Canadian, I paid about $45 for it, so it's probably around $30 American. And it's really nice. It was only a few dollars more than I paid for the Princeton Tech, and I like it. It's quite a bit brighter. It has a battery life indicator. It has a locking feature so that you don't accidentally have it running the whole time that it's in your bag and then go to use it and it's dead. Good compromise between overall battery life and top output, which is around 200 lumens. So for a headlamp that only uses 3 AAA batteries, 200 lumens seemed excellent. So I went with that, and so far it's been great. I use a headlamp all the time, like quite frequently. Whenever I would normally use a flashlight, I've gotten used to using a headlamp because it just leaves both of your hands free. And while I might consider myself a bit of a flashlight nerd, I find I don't check them out so much now that I have a headlamp, because I just find them more convenient. And it might be from, you know, maybe a little bit of a history of working on my own cars, where having the light not in your hands, or needing a third, you know, a second person, a third hand to hold your light in a very specific way, can be pretty helpful. So I really enjoyed the, I'm really liking that, that headlamp. And then, next up, I've got, an article, that I think has some mass appeal. You know, I'm pretty cautious about promoting anything about exercise or fitness. It's a strong focus in my life, and something that I like to learn and read about. But for every exercise or fitness or diet problem or question, there's about 800 answers, and every answer believes that it's the truth. So it seems pretty difficult to try and manage any of the specifics. But ExploreMag.com ran this guy Will Gadd wrote Gadd's Truth: 5 Fitness Commandments to Live By. And they're not the nitty gritty. They're more from a almost philosophical standpoint as to how to approach, not say a specific goal, or I want to be able to deadlift this much, or I want to be able to run this far, but rather a more holistic idea of a lifetime of general fitness. So I won't go into it any further than that. If you are really fit and you don't feel like you need any information at all, then by all means skip it. If it's something that kind of piques your interest, then swing by the show notes and check out The Truth About Aging and Fitness: 5 Fitness Commandments to Live By. I actually think that it's very down to earth, very straightforward, and has some wisdom to provide someone who's more concerned with the long game, being able to do things like dive and climb a hill or a mountain or whatever long into their later years, which is certainly my goal. And I think there was some interesting things in this article, so that's certainly something to check out. Jason, you've got a whole stack of really interesting stuff and a couple things that I read this week and really loved, so I'm excited for your list.
Yeah, I'm on a very specific theme this week. I kind of got into a bit of a jag on cave diving for whatever reason, because I certainly don't do any cave diving. But I think it all started, I caught a video, I don't remember where it was posted, but we'll put a link in the show notes. It was called Diving El Toh, as in El Toh, E-L, separate word, T-O-H. And it's just a beautiful little short film about some guys that go diving in a really clear water cave. I think it's in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. And it's out on Vimeo, and it's a nice high-def movie. Just, you know, there's no dialogue, no narration or anything. It's just beautifully shot. And when you see it, you know, them kind of floating through the interior of this cave, it's just spectacular. It's just otherworldly. So check that out. And then, I don't know, that coincided with an article that popped up on Outside Magazine's website. That was actually an article from the 1990s, and it's called Raising the Dead. And it was about a pretty harrowing adventure. It's a very long article about a body recovery that was done in one of the deepest caves in the world, a place called Bushman's Hole, which is in Africa. And it's a very harrowing story. It's a very interesting story. It really kind of, pardon the pun, goes deep into the world of extreme cave diving, which, you know, we've recommended some books in the past, like Shadow Divers, which seem to resonate with people. And I think If you liked that book at all, and that kind of style of writing and that type of story, I think you should check out Raising the Dead, about kind of the tragic tale of this attempted body recovery at Bushman's Hole. Along the same lines, I just picked up a book called Blind Descent, which was written by an author named James Tabor. And I've only gotten a few pages into it, but it promises to be good, promises to be kind of along that shadow divers sort of theme of sort of adventure journalism. And the book is kind of broken into two sections, one that profiles the attempt to find the deepest spot in the world by one guy whose name is Bill Stone, who is attempting to kind of bottom out in a very deep cave in Mexico. And then the second half of the book is about a Russian caver who is doing the same thing somewhere in one of the former Soviet republics. Like I said, I haven't gotten into it too far, but so far it's I can already tell it's gonna be one of those books I just don't put down. I think cave diving is one of those sports that kind of like, you know, extreme climbing that I prefer to do from an armchair, and it's just great storytelling. So, and then the final note is also a cave diving note, and that is this guy Bill Stone, who was featured in the book Blind Descent. He's actually a really fascinating guy. He started out as a cave explorer, but he's also an engineer by training and an inventor. And in order to kind of push his limits exploring caves underground, he's invented a series of rebreathers, which is a breathing apparatus that recycles your own exhaled air and scrubs out the CO2 so that you have a almost limitless supply of breathing air for very long times underwater. And in addition to that, you know, he's explored all these deep caves, he's invented all this equipment, but he also has this grand plan to drill for oil on the moon and explore outer space. And he did a TED Talk that we're going to put a link to in the show notes that is, it's just fascinating, if not for the topics, but for the guy. I mean, you listen to this guy and he you just believe him. You think he can accomplish all this stuff because he's just so smart, and his ideas are just, he just approaches them very rationally. But it also makes me wonder, like, when does this guy sleep? Because he's just doing so much stuff. And it was pretty inspirational. So check all that out. I think it's, whether or not you're into cave diving or any sort of extreme adventure, I think he alone is just a fascinating person.
Yeah, Bill Stone seems like really pleasantly crazy.
Yeah.
In that he doesn't seem encumbered by the normal limitations that people present on themselves, almost like an Elon Musk.
Yes.
Sort of character where, like, why not appears to be his general opinion of everything. So somebody probably told him, like, oh, you can't dive in a cave for that long or that far. And it was, well, why not? We'll do this. Well, you can't do that. Well, why not? I'll watch.
Yeah.
Like, and he just seems like a guy that seems really fueled by other people's inability to see the solution.
Right.
In many things. His TED Talk is strangely wonderful, and I you know, I'm interested in that Blind Descent. I haven't read that. And then going back all the way to Raising the Dead, man, if it's fantastic long work. It's really well written. There's a great story behind it. You know, it doesn't involve Bill Stone directly, but it's based upon the legacy of his technology. And there's some fantastic storytelling and some fantastic characters. And I find that the stuff about diving, much like in the way with astronauts and with race car drivers, it often circles around the personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it might be as simple as, like, the people writing it can't believe what these people are doing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. there's a few things where you can kind of feel the author in the Raising the Dead. And there was another article, which I'll throw in the show notes, called To Hell and Back, that I really enjoyed that you linked me. But in both of those, you kind of could feel the author, you know, coming through the skin a little bit of the post, kind of being like this is the reality that these people choose to put themselves in.
Yeah.
And it is astounding. It's astounding even as somebody who loves diving,
mm-hmm.
how crazy cave diving seems to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure if someone who is as into these endeavors as the people they're writing about could actually write about them. I think you're right. I think it takes almost an outsider to kind of peer into this and say, these guys are brave and they're smart, but they're absolutely gonzo nuts, you know?
Yeah, there's a bunch of wiring that's better And there's a couple wires that aren't there at all.
Exactly, exactly.
And it's not just cave diving, but cave diving is easily one of the most dangerous sports in the world.
Yes.
You know, it's a tiny circle of people, and kind of like I watched a documentary recently about the cliff divers,
mm-hmm.
like the guys that do the wingsuit diving.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like base jumping, and then when you get tired of just jumping off of things, they have the wingsuit so you can kind of fly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sport that rapidly pushes the barriers, which means that all of this tight-knit, tiny group of people who do the wingsuit flying are constantly losing their friends.
Yeah.
To accidents in the sport, and it felt just like cave diving. None of them were going to stop,
mm-hmm.
and all of them were sad when a friend died. But all of the people involved and their spouses were all oddly on board.
Yeah.
With, like, this is the crazy thing that we've kind of decided to do with our life. And there's something purely crazy about that, and there's something oddly human about it as well.
Right.
Which I think is really inspiring. And yeah, if you liked Shadow Divers, and certainly a lot of people have written us in to say that they enjoyed Shadow Divers, I think you'll enjoy the entire stack of Jason's picks this week.
And as always, thank you so much for listening this week. Hit the show notes, certainly, for more details. And you can follow us on Instagram. I'm at Jason Heaton, and James is at J.E. Stacy. And follow the show at The Grey Nato. If you have any questions for us, please do write thegreynato@gmail.com. And certainly subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts, or grab the feed from thegreynato.com. The music we use throughout is Siesta by Jazzer via the Free Music Archive.
And we'll sign off this week with a quote from alpinist and hero of the show, Ed Viesters, who said, "Mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter."